Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Listening Behind the Curtain here on WGN Plus and also on WGNRadio.com. This is the place where I step away from, well, mostly step away from law and politics and enter the world of usually theater and arts and entertainment. Today, we're just kind of going to touch that world, bring in history a little bit with a view to the world that we live in. My guest is, I've just respected him for so long, Juan Williams, who, of course, you watch on Fox News as one of the political analysts and a political analyst in general. His latest book is called New Prize for These Eyes, The Rise of America's Second Civil Rights Movement. Juan, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. Congratulations on the book. Read it cover to cover. It's super.
Thank you so much, Paul. And let me just say, I appreciate the fact that you have a strong interest in this topic. And I can't tell you, it means a lot to me, because I think for a lot of people, discussions about race can be very prickly and uncomfortable and to be avoided. And Paul dives in and understands the significance, especially as we go through so much demographic change, political change in the country.
That's what makes this book so critical right now, Juan. And I'm not sure when you first started writing this book where you knew where it was going to end up.
No.
In terms of the framework in which you'd now be talking about it. But let's just take a moment. We have a little freedom of time here. Let's take a moment of going back, because your first book, Eyes on the Prize, man, that was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
That was a different planet and a different time. So give me a sense of what was in your mind when you wrote that back then. It accompanied a PBS series, of course. And what's transpired in the following 40 years that led you to say, we kind of need a volume two?
Well, the first book, as you point out, it's a different world. I mean, literally, a moment ago, I was talking to you about the rapid rate of demographic change that's going on in the United States. And it's incredible. I think back to that period I was writing about in the first book, Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, 1954 to 1965, Paul. In that period, 90% of our country is white. That's just who we were, right? And about 10% was black, and there were almost no Latinos. And you think about that moment, what was the significance? The significance was that enough people said, we have to deal with the racial aftermath of slavery, Reconstruction, legal segregation enforced by government agencies and the police, and say that we're going to enforce the Constitution saying that all Americans, without regard to race, have equal rights, and we're going to try to protect them. And then, of course, that's the 64 Voting Rights Act, and it extends then to the 65 Voting Rights Act, that everybody should have the right to vote. And this is an incredible panorama. You mentioned the PBS series on TV, because the visuals are so incredible. You know, people marching famously, for example, across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in the face of state troopers who beat them, people being set upon by dogs, fire hoses, the incredible march on Washington, 1963, Dr. King's incredible I Have a Dream speech. You know, you think about all this, it to me at that time, it was American history that needed to be celebrated and not forgotten. And that's why I wrote the Eyes on the Prize in the late 1980s. And the people who came to me with gratitude were people who were activists during that period, increasingly people who simply wanted to feel that they were part of American history. Now, as you point out, 40 years later, I'm an old man, I'm 70 years old. Here's what I saw, Paul. I look back and I was thinking, boy, this is an incredible movement. It's changed America in so many ways. And then you start and stop and think, wait a minute, America has changed in so many ways in those 40 years. I was talking about demographics, and you think right now we're about 60% white. So we've gone from 90% white to about 60% white. The black population stayed about the same in the 10 to 13% range. But guess what? Blacks are no longer the largest minority group. That's Hispanics. And they're about 20% of the population now. And Asians, the fastest growing segment of the population, pretty much now approaching 10%. That's an incredible change. New voices, new arguments, debates, and then you throw in the reality of the first black president, Barack Obama, and then you throw in the reality that he's followed by a man who claims that Obama wasn't even born in the country and has a really troubled history when it comes to race relations, and that's Donald Trump. And then you throw in all of the Black Lives Matter arguments, and you throw in Tea Party anger at Obama. To me, when we got to 2020 and George Floyd, it's, to me, I just thought, how can this not be understood as a second civil rights movement? The Great March on Washington, about 250,000 people. But after George Floyd is killed, thousands of marches all over the United States, not just in one place, Washington, D.C., all over, and about 26 million people. And there was a global aspect to it, all over the world. So to me, that's why I thought, I've got to help people see that, yeah, we celebrate what happened back in the 50s and 60s, but they should understand right now they're in the midst of a second civil rights movement that arguably is having more clout than the first movement.
And the other thing that's fascinating is that you sort of put the start of the second civil rights movement in the world of, you tie it to Obama's speech in 2004, of course, although I did not know, I loved it in the book that he wasn't even scheduled to give that speech. You
That's
write that it
right.
was supposed to be Gretchen Whitmer.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of curious, a couple of follow-ups from that. Number one, if Obama had never given that speech, I mean, had there never been a Barack Obama, were we on the cusp of a second civil rights movement, or would things not have trans- would this book not exist?
Wow, you're good, Paul. The thing about the Obama speech is that it opened the door to a new way of thinking about race. And it's so complex because, in my mind, if you think back to Dr. King speaking, or you come forward to someone like Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, it's often about the problems besetting black people and the idea that, oh my gosh, people who were enslaved, denied equal rights, denied equal education, denied economic opportunity, even to the point of violence and lynching and all the rest. And how can we repair the damage to this population? Obama comes on the scene, and this is why I thought your question was so rich. What would have happened if he hadn't given that speech? The speech he gave was important only in the sense that it opened the door to people saying, wow, I wonder if we are in a new era of what they called soon post-racial American society. Meaning we're going beyond arguments over what happened to black people in the past, and now we're starting to look at what we could do as a multiracial society to bring about racial justice, racial peace, to make the lived experience of not being white in America more just, more equitable, to deal with so much. And people thought, Obama, his mother's white, his father's a black immigrant from Africa, and he speaks about himself in terms of saying, my joy and love and success could only have happened in one country, and that's the United States. Such an optimistic, positive, forward-looking appeal from a major black figure. So if he hadn't given it, I don't know that we were ready to start talking about post-racial, because I don't think that's what was coming from black leadership at the time. But I think you were starting to see, especially coming from people concerned about race in the Latino community. And, but again, for most Americans, that's outside the framework of what we normally think of as race relations, which is black and white. But now you had Latinos coming in, and you had a higher number of immigrants, even black immigrants coming in. It was shifting the discussion. But when you get somebody like, and he was a tremendous speaker, Barack Obama, on a national audience, the Democratic National Convention in 04, I think it accelerated it. It's like something that was, set, the fire may have been burning in the background with all the demographic shifting going on, but he set it aflame.
But one of the points, and this is also fascinating in the book, it gave me pause. You make the point that Obama may have been an incredible pol and is an incredible politician, but
Right.
you said that's he's not actually seen as the finest of civil rights leaders. So a two-pronged question. Number one, if that's the case, first of all, explain. But secondly, when you get to volume four of this book, say 50 years from now on, my question is, here's what I think. I think that when you go to Washington and there's statues of Martin Luther King there and all of that, I
Right.
could be wrong, but I think your conclusion that Obama, great politician, not civil rights leader, I just think when 50 years comes around, I just think there's a statue of Obama hanging next to Martin Luther King, that that's the way history's going to see him.
Wow, that's interesting. So no one's ever said that to me, Paul. I take that. Let me just think about this for a second, because the premise in this new prize for these eyes, the rise of America's second civil rights movement, is that, in fact, Obama is a great politician, and he appeals to people of all kinds. That's how he got elected president of the United States twice. But when it comes to especially the civil rights activists of this era, they see him as lacking. They think, well, he says he's president of all America. He has somehow, you know, not abdicated, but eschewed the title of first black president. He didn't want that hung on him. He wanted to be seen as the president of any American, regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, all the rest. And so they wanted someone, given it was the first black president, someone who they thought would be more aggressive in pursuing a black-oriented agenda. And he didn't do it. So I'm still stunned looking at the history of it, that sometimes you see black activists, people involved with Black Lives Matter, for example, who refuse to meet with him. Now, can you imagine the president of the United States says, I'll meet with you, let's talk about it, and he's the first black president. And you say no, because I see you as just a politician, just establishment, ho-hum, more of the same. And you think, wow, but that was their call. So when you say we're going to see a statue to Obama, you know, I think we think of Dr. King almost in terms of poetry. You know, judge me not by the color of my skin, the content of my character. You know, we shall overcome. All of that, I don't necessarily attach that to Obama, but I know even to this moment, he remains the most popular politician in the country. Can you believe that? It's unbelievable. And, you
well,
know,
he doesn't have a lot of competition, to be honest with you right now.
Well, but I'm saying it's arguable, Paul, that I want to hear what you think, but it's possible that you'd say he's the opposite. Trump is the opposite. He is the reaction to the first black president Obama, coming from people who were maybe discomforted with the idea of the first black president. And yet, in the Trump era, the polls indicate Obama remains extremely popular, not only with Democrats, I mean, less so obviously with Republicans, but still popular. And so that his numbers are better than any other politician of recent vintage.
Well, listen, if Trump figures out a way to run for that third term, and somebody talks Barack Obama into therefore running for a third term,
right,
that would be an election worth watching. And based on what you're saying, Juan, I don't know who'd win at the end, but one might think Obama might just pull it out.
Well, this is so interesting. Again, in fact, Trump was asked about this recently and said he wishes Obama would get back in it if they both were going to run for a third term, Paul. So I don't know if you were aware of that, but that's, you know, it's yeah. Crazy, right? But there's so much crazy going on. But I do think that, you know, you look back over the last 10 years, you'd say the dominant political figure in American life is Donald Trump. But in the prior 10 years, you'd say the dominant political figure had been Barack Obama. And, you know, they really stand at polls in terms of the discussion of race, not only on terms of skin color, but in terms of attitude. Right now, and you asked me at the start of this interview, you said, you know, when did you start writing this book? Well, I started writing this book in the years in which Biden had defeated Trump. And I was, you know, it was after George Floyd, and I'm still thinking, boy, look at all the civil rights issues that are so bubbling right now. Why don't people see this as a second movement? But right now, the bubbling is almost overflowing the pot. You think about Trump's arguments about diversity, equity, inclusion, and saying that that discriminates against white people. Argument. So who should get admitted to school? Should race be a consideration? Who gets hired? Should race be a consideration in hiring? How about Trump going after culture, like cultural representation? He wants to, he's taken over the Kennedy Center in Washington. He's going after the Smithsonian, and saying we should tell stories that make our children proud. Don't introduce uneasy, difficult topics that make them question their
Well, can I ask you?
patriotism.
I was going there next, and so you're there. So let me just, I just want to tweak it a little bit, which
Sure.
is, given your book ends on, I'd say your book ends on hope. We have perspective in it, but it ends on hope. And yet, given what is going on now, and you literally said it, with the Smithsonian Institution, with the National African American History Museum,
Right.
and the upcoming Women's Museum, not even in existence yet, but we see what it is it's being called for in those aspects. The legislature is neuterized. I mean, they don't exist. So my question is, that's I keep looking at these future books from you, but how impactful, how permanent do you think are the changes now? So in the end, is this all a response? I mean, it clearly is. A lot of it is a response to Barack Obama, but at the same, just historically, but at the same time, 5 years from now, even 10 years from now, whose vision is this country living?
Well,
And I mean, is it Obamian or is it Trumpian?
in part, I think this is, goes back to the start when I was talking to you, and you referenced that the demographic shifts are just incredible, and they're not stopping. You can't stop the reality that America is more diverse and more racially diverse and more immigrant diverse. It's just a different country. And so Trump really celebrates the whole idea of nostalgia for when we had a clear white majority and we didn't have a lot of these conversations that people can find uncomfortable about what's right and wrong with when it comes to race relations. And then, of course, there is the always in the background the same complaint coming, especially from the black activist about, well, look at the disproportionate share of black people who are in poverty. Look at the disproportionate share of black people who get killed by cops. Look at the disproportionate level of achievement in schools between blacks and whites. So that's still there, but it's bubbling and less loud in some ways than the larger conversation about, wait a minute, we are a diverse society and we have to deal with it and you can't just ignore it. And I think a lot of the Trump appeal is, calm down, let's go backwards. Remember his phrase, his famous phrase, make America great again. Like, oh, so when was it great? And he seems to think it was great back in the 50s when we had that overwhelming white population. And we didn't have to have a lot of these discussions because it was simply a matter of a white majority saying, we're going to be fair now. We're going to try to allow black people to have their rights enforced. We didn't have to have all these conversations about things like being anti-racist or, why are cops tough on these black kids? Especially, why do black kids end up in jail in such high numbers, given they're 13% of the population even killed? I think the numbers are like a quarter of the people killed by police are black. Those conversations, you can't stop them, but you can mute them. Diminish them to some extent. But I think the larger thing is we're just a different country. So you say, is it an Obama vision? Is it a Trump vision? Arguably, these are two such powerful forces in terms of our politics. We're going to keep that flame going. But I think the country's also, it's like the world keeps, the globe is circling and people keep changing and the world keeps, you can't stop change. You can't stop the clock.
Well, as you know, the famous phrase, those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And I thought of you and I thought of your book a few days after the Trump speech to the joint session of Congress this year when Al Green was censured. And there are his colleagues on the floor of the well of the House singing We Shall Overcome. And my mind just went to you because I just thought, history repeating itself. There's an anthem. The anthem is coming back now. And yet at the same time, I want to just not necessarily connected, but sort of, which is this notion of that, the Republicans, we back the blue, and yet we see the insurrectionists who beat the crap out of cops and stuff, they get pardoned, they walk, and somehow Trump still stands up, we stand behind our police, which he also said at that joint session of Congress with Capitol Police watching the proceedings. There's a bit of, call it hypocrisy, you can call it what you want, but there's a sort of a, we're doing one thing, we're saying something else, but you're still all with me.
Yeah. You know, I think they appeal, you know, we were talking about the Obama vision versus the Trump vision, but what you're touching on here is the political power, the appeal. Why is it that Trump can get elected when he is, you know, not to offend anyone, but being obviously hypocritical about something so clear as police? You would think that, wait a minute, he is pardoning people who beat the living daylights out of police, ran them over, you know, later their deaths involve all the rest. And this has been determined not by Paul Lesnik or Juan Williams, but by judges, by a judicial proceeding that said, here's the evidence of this bad behavior, and we're putting you in jail and we're fining you. Trump comes back into power.
And jury of your peers, by the way, toss them in there.
Oh, I know. And Trump pardons him and says it's okay, I guess, because not worthy of penalty in support of his. And this is not, you know, something could be debated, an insurrection, because it was about stopping the certification of Joe Biden as president and allowing Trump to resume being president without having won the election, which is still a Trumpian thing that he claims he won the election with no basis.
The reason this conversation is important that we're having right this moment is because you write in the book that we may very well be embarking on a third civil rights movement. Right. And yet listen to what we have just talked about and the things that you have just said. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be my Webster's Dictionary definition of a civil rights movement.
No. When I think about, and the reason I was hinting at a third civil rights movement in the book is I think the Democrats have to learn how to win elections. And part of that is that the activist community has been fairly muted at the start of this second Trump term. You know, we don't see the marches, the protests in the way that we did in the first Trump term, and even anger at Democrat elected politicians like Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, for not being more aggressive, more outgoing in challenging Trump. So we're not seeing that. But I think that the activist who said, oh, Obama's just a politician and I don't want to get involved with establishment politics, I think that they are going to have to say to themselves, politics is where the power resides. And if you want power, if you want to impact the culture and impact race relations, you have to win elections at some point. And so whereas they were moving away from even Obama as establishment politics, I think they have to now become engaged, become activists, political activists, not just civil rights activists, in the name of allowing change to take place. And I think that's a third movement. I see the, you know, we're in springtime, Paul. I see little budding of this all around. You know, recent early election returns in which people are very concerned on the Republican side about how they're doing, to the point that Elise Stefanik, who's a congresswoman who was going to be the UN ambassador, said she's going to stay in the Congress to try to hold on to the Republicans' slim majority. But if they were winning big and the Democrats were to be ignored, she wouldn't have felt the need to do that. I mean, the worry is that a Democrat could win. And I think you're starting to see concern about recession, concern about the impact of government service cuts. You know, they're cutting government workers, but the impact is on government services. Yeah. And you're starting to see people have, oh, wait a second, these are Trump voters who are having concerns. And also, you're seeing Democrats feeling more energized. And I think that, you know, we may think of it in political terms, but I think of it in terms of civil rights and progressive politics terms. And I think you're starting to see people get a sense they've got to get involved to the end of winning elections.
By the way, you may be giving Stefanik a little more credit than she deserves. My understanding is she went kicking and screaming when Trump said, "I need you to stay in the House." She didn't go, "What a great idea, Mr. President."
No, no, no.
Yeah, she apparently called the White House 17 times going, "Can't we figure something else out?" But yeah, anyway, so as you look ahead, because your book, again, the history, you walk through it all. I guess I focus in on this future because, well, because that what's the point of reading this if we're not looking at the future? So here's a multiple choice question for you, Mr. Williams. We reach towards wrapping up the interview. Which is the third civil rights movement, when if it happens, here's your multiple choice question. Is it driven primarily by A, culture, B, demographics, or C, politics? And you can start with A and B, both D and C. And I'm not going to go there. I hated those kinds of questions. But culture, demographics, politics, what from which of those does the third movement emerge?
I think demographics is the big answer here. And it's bigger than politics. It's not necessarily bigger than culture, Paul. And I say that because, you know, if you watch the movies, if you watch, you know, the Oscar awards, or you look at what's winning in terms of the box office or our sports, which is a cultural entertainment platform at this juncture, you look at what's on Broadway or what's streaming, and you start to say, even look at the ads on television, and you say, gosh, you know, I see all kinds of people now featured by the corporation selling products, or you think about who's buying those products, the market, the marketplace. It's and now a real mix of people in a way that it's never been. And then you throw in the global aspect of our economic realities. Again, despite the Trump effort at tariffs, you can't stop this global reality that's taking place, and you can't stop the demographic change that's taking place. Now, it impacts the culture, as I said, and you can see it in the culture, cultural representation of what it means to be American. Suddenly, you see people of color, women, you see it in the Congress, more women than ever in American history. And I mean, we have a black man as Speaker of the House of Representatives after Obama has been the first black president. That's just demographic shifts. And that's a response to the marketplace saying, you know, it's not the old America. This is a new place. So you're going to have these big arguments about, well, who gets to dominate and who gets to say what they want to say and all that. But I think of the choices that you gave me, Professor Lesnik, I would say demographics drives the change.
Fascinating answer. I wasn't sure you'd go there, but I see it. Can I ask when? So I have the hard copy of the book that I've completely read and recommend it. When does the paperback come out? And I have a reason for asking.
I don't know. Obviously, that's up to Simon & Schuster, my wonderful publisher. They've been great.
So the reason I ask is because if you have a little time, it's up to you. It's your life. But I would love, you know how sometimes paperbacks come out and they say an additional chapter added, additional sort of that. There's so much that happened, Juan, since this book came out. This book is valid from beginning to end. But even this conversation, I pushed you a little bit to beyond the last page of the book. I'd love to see in the paperback, you'll sell one more copy by doing it, to sort of say, and here's the latest words based on things that have just happened in this country since this book got finished. I think it's the perfect paperback to have that.
Great idea. You know, I am, you know, when we started and we talked about when I wrote this book, obviously it was before all of this very topical, contemporary front page news generated by Trump's attack on diversity, equity, inclusion, on racial issues, on saying that race should not be allowed as a consideration so many aspects of our lives. And it seems to me just contrary to reality. But you're right. I mean, people are saying to me, well, so what is this third movement? And questions then arise that could be answered in an additional epilogue, if you will, to this book. I don't see this book as an epilogue to the original Eyes on the
Oh, no.
This is its own separate thing. But
this is a book written on a very different planet.
That's what I'm saying to you. I agree, Paul. Yeah.
The book is New Prize for These Eyes, The Rise of America's Second Civil Rights Movement. Juan, if you do add that additional chapter into the paperback, hey, if you want to dedicate it to me, I'm not going to say no.
Great idea. I think that, look, you know, I just want to say again how much I appreciate, Paul, to everyone who's listening in, because again, Paul is willing to dive in. And, you know, this is not an easy topic all the time, but Paul is there, and I appreciate it so much, Paul.
I appreciate you. You know, up until about a month or two ago, I would not have plugged your appearances on Fox News' Sunday morning show because you were up against mine. But they've moved you.
Oh,
So you can catch Juan his team at 8 a.m. on Sunday
okay.
mornings as you get ready for my political report show at 9 a.m. And maybe one day I'll have you come join me on that. That'd be fabulous. Oh, well, I don't know if they can, if you
Wow,
can, but
that'd be cool.
anyway,
All right.
Juan Williams, thanks for all you do. An incredible career. I love watching you, and we'll wait for that paperback book. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks so much.
Take care.